Hi there, and welcome back to the Energy Sector Heroes podcast. My name is Michelle Fraser, and every week I will speak with incredible people who share their lessons, experiences, and stories from their time spent in the energy sector. Hi there, and welcome back again to this week's episode. If you're new to the show, then please take a second to subscribe and even consider sharing the show with just one other person. This week, I am joined by Tony Mapleston. Tony is an incredible consultant. Tony, would you like to introduce yourself, please?
Yes, that's fine, Michelle. Thanks for the opportunity to take part in your program. I've been privileged to work with the training board for quite some years now. Whilst I was working prior to retirement in Aberdeen up to 2015, I held the position of regional chair for the offshore region with ECITB, and I was also an ECITB board member for a while. Following that, 2016, after I formally retired, I was given the opportunity to work with them as a part-time consultant on the development of the Project Collaboration Toolkit, which has been put to use within the industry for some years now, piloted and applied across a number of projects. And I've been working really in support of the application of the collaboration toolkit within UK industry.
Okay, that sounds amazing. What is the Project Collaboration Toolkit?
Well, to give you a little bit of background, to help understanding, at the end of 2014, of course, most of your listeners will be familiar with the oil price crash that occurred at that time, and the offshore energy sector was really plunged into crisis as a result of that. Earlier in 2014, Sir Ian Wood had been commissioned by UK government to produce his MER report, Maximising Economic Recovery. And Serene's report mentioned the real need for in increased collaboration within the industry. And of course, he meant mainly collaboration between client owner operators. But I think his report really implied that collaboration, including collaboration in project delivery, was really, quite necessary. So at the end of 2015, ECITB staged a project management conference in Aberdeen. And when all of the delegates to that conference were asked how they would go about improving collaboration on projects within the industry, the resounding message came back that project practitioners really needed some guidance to work with on how to move in that direction. So that was the idea that generated the development of the Project Collaboration Toolkit. We started drafting the toolkit in early 2016, and then it was launched in its first edition in August of that year.
Okay. So how does the Project Collaboration Toolkit actually work? How does it benefit the industry?
It really is a set of guidance tools that follows the path of a typical project life cycle. So whereas, most projects will have processes and procedures that are followed, throughout a life cycle, the Project Collaboration Toolkit really maps to that. It isn't additional procedure and process. It's more guidance on how to develop the right kind of relationships and the right behaviours to encourage collaboration between the delivery parties. So if an organisation wants to use it, in its entirety, you would expect it to be applied in the very early stages of project development, the period which we would normally think of as front-end loading. Mm-hmm. And that's a very important phase because it actually gives the project lead entity, the client in many cases, and the other partners to the project the opportunity to start working together and developing some trust between the organisations involved. So that's the first part of the first phase of the Project Collaboration Toolkit. As the project moves on into startup, the guidance that the toolkit provides then generally moves towards guidance which is directed towards individuals and, if you like, interpersonal relationships, the kind of relationships that you would want to encourage within the project team. Third phase moving on in the life cycle really covers execution and the theme associated with the guidance and tools in phase three is really all about an integrated team approach. So it's about getting the parties to the project to work on a single path, if you like, to eliminate any inefficiency and to manage important topics like health and safety and quality and even the control of the project, to manage those with a one-team mentality. Whereas on conventional project approaches, there's a tendency to get quite a bit of duplication and overlap within those areas. Final phase of the toolkit, phase four, is really about closing out the project in an appropriate way, so picking up the lessons learned. And very importantly for collaborative undertakings, really kind of driving an understanding of how the experience could actually help and improve the approach on a future collaborative project strategy.
Okay, but then is it quite difficult to create a team where everybody's working unified together?
It is quite difficult, Michelle. It makes it requires a big commitment up front from those who are going to be involved. So it isn't an easy path to take. But I think the benefits that we've actually demonstrated from projects that have worked collaboratively and applied the toolkit will probably far outweigh the effort and energy that is required up front to get the collaboration to come together.
Okay, so what type of companies would normally collaborate together then?
Well, our experience is we piloted the collaboration toolkit on a number of projects in the offshore energy sector. You know, one particularly was one of the project scopes for the Brent decommissioning program. So the organizations have worked together collaboratively for the preparation for topsides removal on Brent Bravo were the client, of course, Shell, you know, the owner operator, Wood, you know, as the managing contractor, and Stork Technical Services, who were the services provider, you know, access, you know, cleaning and other services for the platform preparation. Shell, Wood and Stork had previously had experience of preparing the Delta topsides for removal and disposal. So there was a bit of a track record there, but the results on the topsides preparation on Brent Bravo were nothing short of remarkable, really. A very, very significant reduction in the schedule time required to prepare for single lift removal, a very, very significant reduction in cost, and some pretty innovative approaches to solving some of the problems that were encountered along the way. Yeah.
Okay. But you were saying before that normally if you don't follow the project collaboration toolkit, that you can have a lot of duplications. What duplications can you actually get?
Well, I think typically on projects, and this has been the case for quite some years, Michelle, on conventional project approaches, it's been quite common for, you know, client owner operators to put pretty big teams together with a lot of role duplication and man marking of people in the contractor's delivery team. So it's a pretty inefficient approach, and I think it's because historically within the energy sector, a lot of our client organizations have been looking to have both competition and control in the way they've actually tendered and let contracts for project related work. But there's generally been a bit of an absence of trust, I think. So client organizations have actually teamed up to have expertise which in a lot of cases duplicates the capability that exists elsewhere. And of course, in the present times, with a huge challenge ahead of us on energy transition, you know, the sector really can't afford to continue with, you know, those kind of inefficient approaches. And it really needs to be looking at different and better ways of improving, you know, project outcomes and delivery performance.
Okay. But that sounds amazing. Do you think that there is a lot of difference between running a conventional project?
No, I think the real core issue is sort of getting the right kind of collaborative behaviors and the right kind of relationships. You know, it comes naturally to some organizations and to some people, but it doesn't come quite as easily to people who've been around within the industry for a long time. I think, you know, it all boils down to culture at the end of the day. And culture is a very, very difficult thing to shift without an awful lot of effort and energy. And I think my belief is that, because of some of the challenges that we're facing at the moment, there is a lot of interest now in, taking different approaches and perhaps, using collaborative strategies to deliver some of the challenging projects and programs that are ahead of us. But, the rate of change is quite slow, really. And they'll probably pick up pace within the coming years, hopefully.
But then, do you really think that? I mean, it depends who you're collaborating with as well. But I remember working for a company many, 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 many years ago. We had a collaboration of two contractors, but the contractors were direct competitors of each other, and it was quite difficult for them to work together. I mean, they did work together, but it was quite difficult at times, I think, so to bring the project ahead.
Yeah, no, I can understand that, Michelle. I think in those circumstances, if they were organizations that would normally be competitors within the marketplace, it would be very, very difficult for them to take up a position where they would actually open up to the other party and sort of work in a generally open and sharing way. But just back to, I'll give you an example of a conventional project that I worked on in the period between 2005 and 2008. So at that time I was the project director for a tier one contractor working a retrofit project for a coal-fired power station in the UK. So this was one of a number of projects that were targeted at improving emissions. So it was a flue gas desulfurization project. The client had actually put together a fixed price lump sum contract tender. And it was quite obvious that the tender package included quite a lot of risk that was transferred, from the client to the potential contractor, associated with things like site conditions and ground conditions. I worked on that project and had a very, very stark reminder of how difficult it can be, sort of working projects in that kind of environment. I think to the great credit of, my organisation, the contractor, we managed to deliver the project broadly to schedule, but there was a massive fallout in terms of variations in scope and claims and legal action. And sadly, I think that kind of approach, not just within that part of the industry, but generally, the insistence on transactional type contracts with a lot of transferred risk and very little attempt to try and get the parties working towards common objectives, quite often ends up in adversity and conflict. So as I say, it was a very, 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 very tough experience for me and I think the organisations involved. And I think that probably renewed my commitment to look for different and better ways of for managing to deliver projects successfully.
Yeah, but then how do you resolve conflict between two companies that are working together? That must be really hard, though.
It is, but I think if you if you approach bringing together a collaboration in the very early stages of the project, you have a little bit of time to actually communicate between the parties and develop the foundation of trust that you really need. And the key to it, I think, is to get alignment between all of the parties to a set of goals and objectives that everybody can identify with and take ownership for, really. And I think once you've reached that stage, you can probably look towards handling the ensuing work on almost a dispute-free basis. The parties to the project, if there is an issue arises, will probably sort it out themselves rather than actually have to take recourse to the contract and to the legal framework. Yeah.
Okay. But a lot of the companies do sometimes have to take legal action against each other. It is quite difficult not to. I mean, how do you even resolve that, though?
Well, you know, as I said, there probably isn't a magic answer to it, Michelle. And you know, collaboration isn't a guarantee that projects are going to actually run successfully. But I do think that I've seen enough of the benefits that collaborative strategies can deliver to know that, you know, taking that approach and putting the effort that is necessary into setting up a collaborative project is probably, you know, going a long way towards avoiding really serious fallouts and conflict between, you know, between the delivery partners. Yeah.
Okay. You've sat in a couple of boards, though.
Yeah.
I just wondered, is it challenging to do that?
Yeah. Yeah. It is, Michelle. It is a challenge. It needs effort and a lot of energy. I think the basic requirement is to, you know, for an organization to enter into an effective collaboration, the organization has to be satisfied that it's going to meet its business objectives through achieving the common objectives of the project. And I think if you can get into that position, you're on the winning path. And the way to get there is all about very early dialogue, I think, between you know, the organizations involved. If any one of the organizations in a potential collaboration takes up a position of self-interest, then that can very, very quickly destroy you know, the basis of trust that you really want to develop to get things working the way you want to. Yeah.
Okay, so what kind of tasks do you have to do as a board member then?
What, on a collaborative project?
Yeah, please.
Yeah. Well, I think in the early stages, you'd expect that because of you know, the resistance that is likely to exist within all organizations through culture and past practice, you really need to identify somebody who's going to champion the cause. So identifying and you know, putting somebody in the position of collaboration champion is probably a sensible first step. I think each of the organizations has to do a very realistic self-assessment of where it thinks it is in terms of its capability to, you know, to collaborate. And I think, as you were, you know, questioning earlier, some organizations who've been around in the industry for a long, long time might not be in a very good position in terms of their ability to get into collaboration because they've probably been steeped in, you know, practices that relate to delivering their own business objectives without too much consideration of what impact that might have on others. So a collaborative capability self-assessment would be another sensible step. The toolkit talks about, you know, an event, which doesn't have to be a, you know, a big conference event, but it's called a stakeholder management conference. And the purpose of that is to really get representatives, leadership representatives from all of the organizations who are going to be involved around the table to start talking about objectives, you know, what the objectives of the project are, whether those objectives and the way that they're actually, the way that they're languaged and structured can meet the requirements of all the organizations that need to participate. What sort of behaviors and relationships are, you know, each of those parties looking to develop? Contracting strategy. So if you're going to go into a collaborative undertaking, it would be quite sensible to, you know, enter into a kind of contract framework that supports the collaboration. So a kind of risk-benefit framework where the parties are willing to take a reasonable and proportional share of the project risk for the potential benefit of a share in the upsides if the project succeeds. You know, that kind of arrangement, as established within the contract, would be, you know, the kind of arrangement that you'll be looking for. Although, having said that, lots of the projects that the toolkit was piloted against really kind of stuck with pretty straightforward conventional contract forms and still identified some very, very successful, you know, outcome benefits. Brent Bravo, as we mentioned earlier, the Brent Bravo project between the three principal parties, the contract arrangement was basically a reimbursable contract with an opportunity for additional margin gain by both Wood and Stark Technical Services through a register of KPIs.
Okay. And how does that work then?
Well, the KPIs are established to identify and align with, you know, some of the objectives, you know, time saving, cost saving, and just general behavioural performance in support of the collaboration. And on that particular project, Shell, on a monthly basis, you know, sat down with both of the other parties and scored the performance against KPIs. And there was an additional, you know, sort of small percentage available to each of those parties in addition to its normal reimbursable margin.
Okay. Do you think that there is any challenges to working in this type of environment, though, with the project collaboration?
I think so, Michelle. I think there are some big challenges. It's early days. It's not a particularly comfortable path for a lot of organisations to be taking. But I think we're rapidly getting to the stage where if we don't actually look for different ways of working to deliver these challenging energy transition projects successfully, then we aren't going to actually deliver to the timescale that's expected. I think there's a lot of interest, not just within the UK, but there's a lot of global interest growing, I think, in taking a collaborative approach. I've just finished drafting some training materials for ECITB, which it's intended to actually put on the training board's learner experience platform as an e-learning package. And the training package actually contains references to some of the work that's been going on in North America and Canada and Australia around collaboration and partnering and alliancing. A lot of it, has to be said, is targeted at the built environment and infrastructure projects rather than, if you like, industrial process plant type projects. But it's interesting nevertheless that that's the direction of travel that a lot of countries and organizations in the world seem to be taking.
Okay. So do you think that it will benefit the industry then going forward, especially with the renewables as well?
Undoubtedly, yeah. I just think that once the industry gets more comfortable with, the change that is required, to take a different direction to the direction that it's got comfortable with, despite the fact that, the performance record on projects, that have been managed in the conventional way isn't particularly good. An awful lot of major projects have a history of overrunning budget, taking far too much time and, not by small margins. A lot of them actually exceed budget by, a very, very high percentage and, take a lot more time than, was originally planned. So despite that track record, there's still resistance, I think, to moving in the direction of, collaborative approaches. But there's now a body of evidence, I think, that we have through case studies that we've developed from, projects that have worked with the likes of the collaboration toolkit to suggest that it's a different way of working, which is certainly worth further adoption.
But do you think it is? Do you think it is realistic to say that projects can come within budget and on time? I mean, a lot of them don't. I mean, I've been a project worker for quite a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them do overrun for various different reasons. But a lot of them do come in time as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's quite right, Michelle. Some do and some don't. But I think the percentage split on conventional projects isn't particularly encouraging. A lot, of course, different reasons for projects not succeeding in terms of sticking to budget and schedule, but many major projects, of course, probably go into the the delivery phase without being adequately scoped. So there's a lot of emergent scope and change that actually gets in the way, requiring more time and requiring more money. So yes, I mean, I accept that you know, some conventional projects are successful, but I just think that this different way of working actually just addresses the balance between the number of projects that will succeed and the number that might fail. They're probably more resource efficient because, in general, if you're working in an integrated team environment, you're probably using less human resource than you would require on a conventional project. And I think, given the challenges that you know, we're facing in energy transition, and of course, there's a lot of other stuff going on in other industry sectors as well, there's going to be a shortage, I think, an overall shortage of qualified project and engineering construction resource, you know, not just in the UK, but, you know, probably throughout the world. Yeah.
No, I think that is right. I think there is more, less and less people coming into the energy sector as a whole, actually, especially in engineering, actually.
Yeah.
Yep. But do you really think that it can help define a good FEED? Because sometimes you can go into FEED with all the best intentions, and you think you know your design, but then some way down the line, you might think that your design of what you originally wanted to design might have to change. And then it would almost be like you would have to then change to go backwards again, to almost start from the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, some projects are like that, Michelle. So I think you're quite right to point out that, you know, in some cases, you know, even though you believe you've actually done a good job in FEED, you know, there's a requirement to do an iteration because, you know, something will happen which will require, you know, an element of emergent scope might occur that requires a change in direction, you know, in the way that the project moves into, you know, moves into execution. So those are very real issues, I think, and collaboration probably won't solve those. I think what collaboration would do in those circumstances is get all of the parties looking for the most expedient way to move the project forward. So you wouldn't get, for example, you know, a contractor in a collaboration necessarily looking to make capital out of a change in direction or a change in scope. I think the evidence is that successful collaborations actually get people thinking very creatively and innovative in an innovative way to look for you know, the most appropriate solutions for the project rather than the most appropriate solutions for themselves.
Okay. But then I thought in a project that you would, especially all the projects that I've ever worked on, that you always have to work for as a team for one gain, for the benefit of the company and the benefit of the project that you're working on.
Well, I think in an ideal world, that's the case, Michelle, but it doesn't always happen. So I've had experiences of, you know, sort of projects where organizations have actually tendered, you know, for, you know, part of the work scope, that they've been hungry for the work and they've probably submitted what I would refer to as a heroic bid. So to win the work, they've actually, you know, cut the, you know, the price to the bone and the expectation that if they secure the work, they'll then be able to make capital out of changes in the work scope, you know, to get the opportunity to recover some of the margin. And those kind of things, those kind of practices have hampered performance, I think, you know, across projects in the sector for quite some time. You've probably seen it yourself, I would guess. Yeah.
Yeah, I have done. But do you think that that's ever really going to go away, though?
I would like to think that if it doesn't go away altogether, that there's a more realistic approach to, you know, satisfying the needs of all of the organizations that support project delivery without kind of taking a win-lose approach and, if you like, taking up a position of, you know, ultimate self-interest. Because that's what it amounts to, you know, one organization looking after its own interests to the detriment of others that are involved.
Okay. So which type of project do you actually think is more benefit, a lump sum project or a more conventionally funded project then?
Well, I think lump sum arrangements, of course, are transactional, and they have their place. So I would expect that lump sum fixed price contracts apply to projects that have a very, very clearly defined scope, very low risk of, scope change, a clear understanding between the client, the, project lead entity, and whoever the contracted party is. Those arrangements are absolutely fine. I think the evidence is that complex projects with complex work scopes, lots of organizations, lots of stakeholders involved in the delivery, those kind of projects are probably, better served by an approach which is more collaborative. So, fixed price arrangements in those circumstances are never going to encourage the kind of, working together, one team approach that you'd really like to see on a project, which has all of the parties aligned to a single set of objectives. Does that answer?
It does. So would you be able to work in the project collaboration under a fixed term budget?
I think difficult because, having said that, collaboration is all about relationships and behaviours, and fixed price, lump sum arrangements being, transactional, really don't give, the kind of opportunities to develop those relationships that you would really want. Having issued the toolkit and seen it work in the years since 2016, when it was being launched in its second edition in 2020, myself and a guy who is currently the chair of the European Construction Institute identified a bit of a gap, I think, in the availability of a type of contract that would ideally suit multiple parties working in a collaborative environment. So we went to work in 2020, 2021 and developed an agreement which goes under the title of the Collaborative Working Agreement. It's based upon some of the content and some of the principles that are set out in the collaboration toolkit, but it really is a kind of multi-party, collaborative framework which is set around a number of foundational principles that all of the parties are signing up to collaborate to achieve a common set of objectives. That's actually set out in the contract itself. And that's starting to actually see some use, in parts of the industry. It's available through the European Construction Institute, by application, I think, through the Institute's website. So that's the kind of agreement. And there are other frameworks, alliance and partnering frameworks that could be used. But those are the kind of arrangements, I think, that contractually better suit collaborations rather than the, fixed price, lump sum, transactional type contracts.
Okay. It was amazing talking to you, actually. It's a really interesting topic that I think that will benefit a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure it is, Michelle, and I think your line of questioning was very good because there'll be lots of people, in our industry at the moment who are quite sceptical about this. This is all about, people and organisations who are, if you like, locked in the present culture, and it's very, very difficult to change that, that culture. So, I believe, and I've seen enough about the application of the toolkit to know that collaboration has its place. It isn't a solution to everybody's problems, but I think the more projects, the more complex major projects that apply collaborative strategies, the better, I think, because it generally does sort of load the platform for success.
I think so too. I think so too, actually. That's all the questions I have today. I would like to thank Tony for your time. That brings us to the end of another episode. Thanks for listening and see you next week. That brings us to the end of another episode. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, I'd like to gently encourage you to leave a 5-star rating wherever you listen to podcasts and share the show with another person. You can also follow me on LinkedIn or via my website, www.michellefraserconsultancy.com. Thanks again for listening and see you next week.